Welcome to WHRO's Weekly Edition. I'm Jordan Christie.
And I'm Barry Graham.
We highlight the week's news and stories happening all over Hampton Roads. Happy Juneteenth and Father's Day weekend from everyone here at WHRV. In this week's program, Old Dominion University President Brian Hemphill received a five-year extension this week despite a vote of no confidence from the Faculty Senate back in March.
Hampton Roads Transit riders, get ready. The organization announced a change in bus routes starting next year. Some routes will be nixed or absorbed into larger routes.
And VCIJ's Kunle Faliyi teamed up with a Virginia Beach treasure hunter to help a Richmond couple locate a lost wedding ring on the oceanfront's sandy surf. It's WHRO's Weekly Edition. Early voting in party primaries for November's congressional elections has begun. WHRO's Michelle Hankerson breaks down which candidates are on the ballot.
Congressional primaries are later than normal this election cycle because of Virginia's effort to change district boundaries earlier this year. While a proposed map was thrown out by courts, it didn't invalidate a legislative change to primary dates. Election day for primaries is now August 4th. There is a Republican primary to pick a challenger to U.S. Senator Mark Warner. House of Representatives districts 1 and 2 will also have Democratic primaries. The winner of the first district primary will face Republican Representative Rob Whitman. The second district primary winner will face Jen Kiggins, also a Republican. Michelle Hankerson, WHRO News.
Old Dominion University President Brian Hemphill received a five-year contract extension announced Monday. WHRO's Ashley White reports it positions him to lead the college through 2032.
Hemphill was selected as the university's ninth president in July 2021. He is the college's first Black president. In a statement, Hemphill said serving as ODU's president, quote, is the honor of my professional career. The Board of Visitors praised Hemphill for overseeing the merging of ODU and Eastern Virginia Medical School and growth in research, philanthropy, and enrollment. It said the extension means Hemphill will continue to lead the university with a focus on research, workforce development, student success, and regional economic impact. Despite the board's praise, Hemphill's tenure has not been without friction. In March, ODU's Faculty Senate voted no confidence in university leadership. It also criticized Hemphill for not addressing security concerns raised in 2024 before a fatal shooting at Constant Hall on March 12th. Ashley White, WHRO News.
Congressional Democrats from Virginia say the Department of Defense has failed to fulfill a program for disaster resilience at military bases. WHRO's Catherine Hafner has more on the vulnerabilities of local bases.
Congress passed the initiative 3 years ago. It directed DOD to appoint a regional resilience coordinator at four installations across the country. Hampton Roads Congressman Bobby Scott says many military communities are vulnerable to flooding, and that threatens national security.
I think people in this area are aware that the military bases are subject to sea level rise. If we're going to maintain these military assets, we have to make sure that we have a long-term plan.
For example, he says Langley Air Force Base in Hampton has sometimes been inundated by several feet of water. Naval Station Norfolk was the first and only base to actually be assigned a resilience coordinator, but the position is now vacant. Scott and more than a dozen other lawmakers sent a letter to Secretary Pete Hegseth Monday asking for answers. Catherine Hafner, WHRO News.
A development plan for the Virginia Beach National Golf Club property would refurbish the course and add housing. WHRO's John Doucette breaks down the proposed blueprint.
The city unveiled a preferred plan for the course, which the city says could solve its maintenance needs. The plan by the Dragas companies includes 659 for sale housing units and a daycare center. On Tuesday, Vice Mayor Rosemary Wilson said it could be an important project.
And it's going to give our citizens a great golf course that people are going to drive and come here as a destination.
Helen Dragas, president and CEO of the Dragas Companies, said a range of housing styles are planned and homes won't interfere with play on the course.
We feel like it's a comprehensive package of benefits for the community that also creates a fantastic tax base for the city and relieves it of the liability of bringing the course maintenance needs back up.
Public comment is scheduled July 7th. Council may vote on it July 14th. John Doucette, WHRO News.
There's an island toward the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay where time does not stand still. Nature is making a comeback thanks to a hands-off approach and tight protocols for public access. Jeremy Cox, a reporter for the Chesapeake Bay Journal, brings us the story.
There's a story that park rangers like to tell about Fisherman Island. It underscores how nothing stays the same here for long. Here's Lydia Hansen of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service addressing a recent tour group.
In the very early 1600s, Captain John Smith was exploring the Eastern Shore, and he started at the southernmost island, and liked it so much, he named it after himself, and then
he named it Smith Island, but that's not where the story ends.
But Smith Island is not the southernmost island. Which one is?
Someone quietly says the answer.
Fisherman Island, right. So how did he miss it? And it's a very simple answer. And the answer is that it did not exist at that time.
In Smith's day, there was nothing here but open water. But around 1815, a sandbar started to form. Over time, water currents continued working their magic until, voila, Fisherman Island was born. Today, it stretches across 2,000 acres. That's about 2.5 times the size of New York Central Park. If you've ever traveled by car between Virginia Beach and Virginia's Eastern Shore, you probably traveled across Fisherman Island. But chances are, you've never been able to set foot there. That's because visitors usually aren't allowed. The only way to explore this place is to score a reservation on a ranger-led tour.
Sounds good.
Let's get going.
We get into our cars at the visitor center on the mainland and make the short drive to Fisherman Island. Here, we're directed to a small, unmarked pull-off with maybe enough room for 10 vehicles. We're greeted by a volunteer. He's a retired firefighter named Paul Tiffany.
Come on down, everybody!
Who lets us through a gate. At a glance, everything looks like it's been here forever. The bleached deer skulls, the yellow-rumped warblers, the salt marsh keeping the Chesapeake Bay literally at bay. But looks can be deceiving. Tiffany draws our attention to some stray metal objects, signs that say this was a military base. The Navy left for good in 1969, but they didn't take everything.
And in true fashion, when they leave, they just drop and run. So there's pieces of an old stove over here, there's pipes. There used to be a big boiler over here. They just left it, and nature's taking its course.
Nature has had free rein to do pretty much as it pleases for the past 50-plus years. Hansen again.
We don't really manage this place much. We sort of just let nature take its course. The only management we do is just monitoring the shorebird nests, making sure they're doing okay.
Fisherman Island is a national wildlife refuge.
Anybody know what my friend here is?
Horseshoe crab.
That means wildlife conservation is the top priority here. Shorebirds, to be specific.
It's because of the geography of the area that makes this such an important place.
Fisherman Island is on the Atlantic Flyway. It's a 3,000-mile avian interstate reaching from the Canadian Arctic to the Caribbean. This is the last island before the open bay, so it's a super important rest stop for birds during the fall migration. Public access is 100% closed from March through September to give these vulnerable bird species the privacy they need. If a person were to accidentally scare birds away from a nest,
so all of the effort for that year is lost.
So visitors have to be content with these carefully orchestrated walks. They're only offered on Saturdays from October through February. If you visit, you can bet on Fisherman Island being bigger than it was during my trip. Officials say the island is still growing. You can't miss it. Jeremy Cox, Chesapeake Bay Journal.
Still ahead on Weekly Edition, the City of Suffolk will end its curbside recycling program next month. But first, USS Mitcher arrived home after a deployment that rivaled the carrier USS Ford. WHRO's Steve Walsh was there for the homecoming.
The destroyer USS Mitcher pulls into Norfolk Tuesday morning. Jessica Johnson waits on the dock for her son Christian Taylor to arrive. It's his first deployment. She deployed several times when she was in the Navy, but nothing close to the nearly 11 months the Mitcher spent at sea.
No, that was unheard of actually at the time. It was only 6 month deployment back then.
The ship deployed a month after USS Ford and worked with other carriers in the fleet, including USS Abraham Lincoln during Operation Epic Fury. Destroyers are the workhorses of the fleet. The captain did not know if Mitcher had broken a record. Steve Walsh, WHRO News.
The Virginia Beach Development Authority approved an agreement with Dominion Energy for land that could support more offshore wind. WHRO's Catherine Hafner has details on what the company is considering.
Dominion paid Avangrid $160 million in 2024 to take over a wind lease site off the Outer Banks coast. It's separate from the wind farm currently under construction east of the Virginia Beach oceanfront. Dominion says the North Carolina site is just an option for future development. Officials don't have a firm timeline or cost, but they'll need some onshore land to make it happen. The agreement with Virginia Beach allows the utility to buy about 30 acres at Corporate Landing Business Park within the next 5 years. It would be used for an onshore substation and grid interconnection point. The North Carolina project would not launch until the mid-2030s. It could power up to 200,000 homes. Catherine Hafner, WHRO News.
Attention to all Hampton Roads Transit riders. The service will be switching up its bus routes starting next year. WHRO's Toby Cox says some routes will have more frequent service, while others will be discontinued or absorbed into more popular lines.
Thomas Becker with HRT says a couple of things prompted the updates. One, the shortage of bus operators got worse during the COVID-19 pandemic and never recovered. And two, HRT hasn't really made big changes to its bus network since 1999.
It was ready for an overhaul because job centers change, development changes, where people move changes.
HRT will discontinue 14 bus routes across the region that are redundant or unpopular. Becker says this will give HRT room to offer bus service every 15 minutes during morning and evening rush hours on its most popular routes. And people may notice some new stops. Last month, HRT started service between Norfolk and the Amazon Fulfillment Center in Virginia Beach. Next year, buses will run from downtown Norfolk to the Norfolk International Airport. Toby Cox, WHRO News.
The U.S. military wants troops on the front lines to be able to make their own food. Literally, it's trying to develop ways to use microbes to create meals using a process that would look more at home in a laboratory than in a kitchen. Jay Price of the American Homefront Project reports on the futuristic quest for alternative proteins.
That thing that Napoleon supposedly said about armies marching on their stomachs, it still resonates. But in an age when combat might mean hunkering down for days without a way to sneak food shipments past swarms of enemy attack drones, it's a problem. One potential solution may be the kind of equipment found in a couple of labs at North Carolina State University.
The tanks that you see are what we call bioreactors.
Rohan Schierweiker is director of the university's Bezos Center for Sustainable Protein. He's standing outside a glass-walled lab, gesturing inside at several gleaming stainless steel tanks about as tall as a person. They look like smaller versions of the tanks you might see at a brew pub, but surrounded by a lot more pipes, valves, and wires. Microbes grown in such tanks can be engineered for attributes like high levels of protein and other nutrients, and for taste, or programmed to act like tiny factories producing molecules of useful substances like proteins and fats. The Army recently put out a call for proposals for ways to make such proteins. Its long-term goal is to foster the development of portable equipment small enough for units on the front lines to create their own food. Nicole Favreau-Farhadi is a research chemist for the U.S. Army Combat Capabilities Development Command Soldier Center, the lab that put out the proteins proposal.
Basically, we would be able to produce food where and when it's needed. It would be nutrient dense, and no military in the history has ever had that capability.
Farhadi is careful, though, to characterize the idea of food production in combat zones as a distant goal. The more immediate plan is to use the technology to increase the nutrition density of MREs, the packaged meals that soldiers eat in the field. It's essential, Farhadi says, for MREs to get lighter.
Warfighters carry anywhere from 60 to 100 pounds of gear, and every pound that we can remove translates directly to speed, endurance, reduced injury rates, and the conventional protein sources are very heavy.
And she says decreasing the size and weight of rations has another benefit. The smaller or less frequent they are, the harder food shipments are for enemies to target and destroy with drones or precision long-range missiles.
every calorie that has to travel from the continental United States could be delayed, it could be destroyed. And so the goal is for better protein that travels better.
Alternative proteins could also provide new options for meatless and plant-based field rations, things that troops have increasingly asked for. And while growing nutritious, good-tasting food in tanks may sound unlikely, it's already being done. Examples include some of the meat substitutes you can find in supermarkets, like corn, spelled Q-U-O-R-N, which is made from a microfungus usually found in soil. Insulin, the diabetes drug, also has been made in this way for decades, as has rennet, a key ingredient in cheese. Adam Lehman is a scientist with the Good Food Institute, a think tank focused on accelerating the use of plant-based and cultivated proteins.
The technology is ready. The infrastructure is small but growing to actually be able to provide these ingredients. So I think these will demonstrate that they're good sources of protein for folks, that they can meet the military specs and can be used widely.
And maybe one day, even be made by the troops themselves. I'm Jay Price reporting.
William and Mary's Lemon Project helps African Americans in Williamsburg uncover their families' histories. WHRO's Nick McNamara gives us the details on how it works.
Juwan Johnson is the Lemon Project's interim director. He helped establish its public genealogical research about 5 years ago.
It resonates deeply if you have been told for generations that you did not make a substantive contribution to the building of a nation. And now you have the records that say, yes, I did. I did build this place. My people were here.
It can be difficult work. Many records were lost during the Civil War. In other cases, records on enslaved people never existed. But Johnson says they make plenty of breakthroughs using William and Mary collections and records from the Library of Virginia and the Freedmen's Bureau. Johnson says church histories and Black residents' oral histories can provide new leads when there's gaps.
We think that they're worth the search, they're worth the labor.
Nick McNamara, WHRO News.
Chalk the Walk brought artists to Virginia Beach's oceanfront to brighten up the boardwalk. WHRO's John Doucette brings us sound from the event.
Chalk the Walk gathers students, amateurs, and professional artists. They make vibrant chalk drawings. The boardwalk is their canvas. Nicole Von Kuhl of Alexandria was this year's featured artist. She says the event is an opportunity for everyone, including young artists, to grow.
It is really a wonderful thing to get young artists involved early. I was involved early. It was all my mom's idea to start joining a festival just like this, where it's just free entry. You can come, you can draw, showcase your talents, and every time you come back, you get to practice a little more.
Justice Miller is a Bayside Middle School student who is among the youngest artists Saturday. She heard about the event through her mom and hopes people will be inspired by her work.
Whatever you draw, it's like you. It's like you're expressing your feelings.
John Doucette, WHRO News.
The NASCAR journalist Steve Wade has died at 77 following a long illness. WHRO's Michelle Hankerson reports on the NASCAR Hall of Famer's Hampton Roads roots.
Steve Wade was a decorated American motorsports journalist who started his career at the Martinsville Bulletin. He was born in Richmond and spent a portion of his childhood in Virginia Beach. He graduated from Old Dominion University in 1970. Wade moved to the Roanoke Times newspaper in the early 70s. He transitioned into national NASCAR reporting in 1981. He wrote for and led a variety of racing publications until he retired in 2010. He's a member of the NASCAR Hall of Fame and started a podcast in 2018. Wade died in North Carolina. There's no information about public services. Michelle Hankerson, WHRO News.
Suffolk residents, be prepared. The city will end its curbside recycling program next month. WHRO's Catherine Hafner fills us in on the city's new system.
City officials say they're moving away from the traditional curbside system in favor of a new regional initiative led by the Southeastern Public Service Authority. Starting July 1st, Suffolk residents will no longer need to separate trash and recyclables. It will all be jumbled together and sent to a sorting facility in Portsmouth. The new plant uses artificial intelligence to extract recyclable stuff from trash. Organic material, like food waste, will be turned into a reusable substance called biochar. The goal is to reduce the amount of trash going to the Suffolk landfill, which would otherwise run out of space in the next few decades. Catherine Hafner, WHRO News.
A Virginia Beach treasure hunter turned up a surprising find at the oceanfront a week ago, much to the relief of a Richmond-area couple and their friends.
Coonley Folley with the Virginia Center for Investigative Journalism at WHRO was there and reports.
Tolson Bukola Ugwade. We're enjoying a beach day at Virginia Beach's oceanfront with family and friends from the Richmond area church on a simmering Saturday afternoon. They laid out tents, spread out platters of food, and a few of them decided to take a dip in the water. Bukola was holding her husband's diamond-studded anniversary ring for safekeeping.
I was playing soccer on the beach and my instinct told me to remove my band and give it to my spouse just to hold. And that was it.
Disaster struck. Bukola jumped into the surf, forgetting the ring in her hand. Before she realized, the ring had dropped into knee-deep water. Friends and family immediately started searching. The group spent about 20 minutes combing through the sand beneath the waves. Nothing.
I've given up. After 20 minutes, I was like, okay, this is gone.
Then came James Whitfield, 62, wearing black shorts, a white t-shirt, and bright yellow headphones plugged into a Manticore metal detector. The Chesapeake resident has walked Hampton Roads beaches on weekends in the past 15 years, looking for lost valuables and historical artifacts. By day, he is a building contractor. On this recent Saturday, Whitfield hunted through the sand near 24th Street, walking the shoreline. The Ogwades were about to give up on their search before asking him for help. He did not hesitate.
The location which he lost it in the surf, the ocean moves the item usually so far away that it's hard to find.
Whitfield waded into the water. His detector swept back and forth through the surf. Then came a promising signal. A few beeps. One scoop of sand. There it was. The missing ring.
You found it? He found it!
Luckily, his ring was so heavy, it went down and didn't go anywhere.
Whitfield had just found a ring lost in 2 feet of churning ocean in less than 10 seconds. The church party and curious onlookers cheered. The Ogwade's friends and families hugged him.
I was surprised by how many people celebrated. Usually it's just the person who lost the ring and the spouse usually get the most excited, but everybody was excited that day. It was really nice.
Whitfield declined any payment for the find, which the people present called a miracle.
I was like, what? This is impossible. Everybody was excited. I mean, we had fun. Jumping up, took pictures with him.
When told the ring was worth $15,000, a surprised Whitfield said it was the most expensive item he had ever found. For the hobbyist, the real reward wasn't the ring. It was seeing a family's panic turned into joy. Kunle Falai, the Virginia Center for Investigative Journalism at WHRO.
You've been listening to WHRO's Weekly Edition. We had help today from WHRO's Toby Cox, John Doucette, Catherine Hefner, Michelle Hankerson, Nick McNamara, Steve Walsh, and Ashley White.
VCIJ's Kunle Falai, the Chesapeake Bay Journal's Jeremy Cox, and Jay Price with the American Homefront Project. Also Connor Worley, who produced today's show.
A reminder that you can always catch full episodes on the Weekly Edition podcast feed.
You can get your news updates at WHRO.org and the WHRO Reports podcast feed.
For all of us at WHRO and WHRV, I'm Barry Graham.
And I'm Jordan Christie. Have a great weekend.